Okay, so it's called Arachne's Daughters.
Arachne's Daughters. The following document, which was found in our archives recently, is a transcript of the talk given to the inaugural meeting of the Lesbo-Arachnid League of Friendship on the 29th of February 1992, old calendar. It is published here for the first time to commemorate the 13th anniversary of the revolution. Our recently retired archivist, who attended that first meeting, remembers that the speaker made a dramatic entrance, abseiling onto the platform. Unfortunately, due to her size, much of the audience was unable to see her once she had landed, owing to the overexuberance of the floral arrangements.
Good evening, ladies. Madam Chairwoman, thank you for coming. My subject for this evening is closer cooperation between lesbians and arachnids. I would like to discuss with you the mutual benefits of this closer cooperation, but first, I'll dispel some of the myths surrounding our culture in order to help you to contemplate the closer links I advocate. Some of you may feel uncomfortable with some of the things I have to say, but please bear with me. Many women have a deep and abiding loathing of spiders, as you call us. I accept that, but I want to explain why this paranoia exists. To do that, I will have to explain arachnophobia. To show it to you as the persecution of spider kind that it is. You think witches were persecuted. Right, but that was centuries ago, and cats certainly, but they're pampered pets now. How many people do you know who even pass the time of day with a spider? I shall embarrass you now, I am afraid. Hands up, anyone? I mean, anyone who can honestly say she has never killed a spider. Yeah, thought so. What is the problem? Do we have too many legs? Is that it? All the more to run away with, I assure you. Have you ever noticed the way your resident spider hunches up in fear when you come into the room, plays dead until she has a chance to use her legs to run for cover? She is hoping you won't put her out in the rain. Or let the cat play with her, or just step on her. She isn't going to hang around and give you good advice under those circumstances, is she? Which is a pity. She could become your best friend if you'd only let her. We are on your side, sisters, and we have plenty to offer. Try saying hello next time you see Susanna in the garden, or Babette scaling your cooker. You might be pleasantly surprised. It can be quite cuddly. Which I suppose brings us on to sex and black widows. Now, this is one of the areas that you lot seem to have a real problem with, although I can't for the life of me understand why. All spiders eat all spiders. I mean, if you don't have the sense to steer clear of your neighbours when they're hungry, you take a chance. It's that simple. It doesn't happen all that often. There are codes we use, like musical doorbells. One taps out a message on the fence. I am not dinner. And if you're in luck, the lady of the house will tell you which fence to avoid stepping on. Of course, copulation makes the female spider very hungry, so any male runs the risk of being eaten after the act. Or if he's very juicy before. So, let me tell you about Arachne. She is supposed to have been a human, a very skilled spinner and weaver. So far, so good. She is also supposed to have been proud and boastful. I think uppity would be a good word to describe Arachne. So this clever weaver challenges Athene, you remember Athene, to a contest to see who is the best weaver. Loses and hangs herself. Then Athene is supposed to have turned her into a spider. Can you believe anybody would be that stupid? I don't believe it. No one could expect to surpass a goddess at anything. And I would have thought Athene would have been pleased a woman was so good. So why would Athene have accepted the challenge, if indeed that challenge was ever made? This myth was invented by, you guessed it, men. They wanted you to think that being a spider was a step down from being a woman and a punishment for being too clever. This serves a twofold purpose, preventing you from taking pride in anything you do, even the things they expect you to be good at, and discouraging you from associating with spiders. In fact, Arachne was always a spider and a symbol of womanly virtues and strengths. Strengths such as tenacity and courage and pride. Arachne was so popular with human females that men wanted to find a way of destroying the cult. They even went to the trouble of changing the calendar to lose the month named for her. I bet they wish they could have changed the moon's turnings too to make it fit their 12 months. Nice try, fellas. Forgot something though, didn't they? How many Cancers and Scorpios are there in the audience?
Yes.
Yes.
Greetings, cousins.
And that's where we'll leave that one.
Yeah.
It ranks on a bit. And this is called Death and Other Rituals. It's by Tanith Perry. Camille opens the cupboard, instinctively reaching past Hortensia's cow-patterned mug for her own cup with Chinese characters and a blue dragon. Then she turned back to the table and saw the pile of newspapers and the blank sheet of paper and pen. She was meant to be writing Hortensia's obituary, the newspapers there as a guide. If she wanted it to go in this Sunday's edition, it had to be done today. But this was her second attempt, as she had found that all the things she wanted to say should not, could not be said. Hortensia Jones smoked a cigar every birthday, even though she couldn't stand the taste. Hortensia Jones had never kissed any woman other than Camille and was proud of the fact. Hortensia Jones had once got into a fist fight with a man who was kicking his dog and had come home with a bruised cheek and grazed knuckles. Hortensia Jones, it was useless. She put down the pen. The coffin brochure was at her elbow. Hortensia, with typical breezy thoughtlessness, had said she didn't care. Pick whatever's cheap and easy. Or maybe something strange that'll make people sit up and stare. Or just cremate me and throw the ashes into Mrs. Capper's garden. I'll do my best to ruin her washing, miserable old bat. Which, of course, was not helpful now that Camille did have to choose. There was a knock on the door. As she was pulling it open, she realised she didn't want to talk to anyone and should have pretended not to be at home. But it was too late now. Mr. Teed was standing on the step, his eyebrows, as usual, growing in every cardinal direction. He pushed the casserole dish into her arms. "Shepherd's pie, made by my wife, sends her regards," he said. "Thank you," she said. "You're all right, all by yourself in this big house. Maybe you should think of getting a boarder or a dog." "The Calvins just had puppies," he said. His image grew blurry for a second and Camille turned away to place the baking dish on the side table, surreptitiously wiping away a tear as she did so. Hortensia would have snorted at this. The Calvins having puppies, their freckled faces contorted in pain as they gave birth to spaniels. But it wasn't funny at all now, and it never would be. "I'll think about it," she said. "When's the funeral?" He rocked back and forth on his feet. "I don't know yet." She tried not to hate him. No one had shown much concern when Hortensia was ill. If the two of them went out together, people looked the other way. It was as if they feared that at any moment, Hortensia would throw Camille down on the pavement and make mad lesbian love with her. Only when they went out singly were they acknowledged. And now that Camille was forever single, the whole village seemed to want to speak to her. Well, I have a story, and it's called A Place of Departures. It's one of mine. And it's a guided walk around Rotherhithe, taken possibly by a ghost. Rotherhithe is a place of departures, of ghosts hesitating on the threshold of a new life, a new world, an afterlife. Through this alley, from here, you might have seen Captain Kidd dance at the end of the hangman's rope across the water at Wapping, or felt the brush of Fear Brewster's dress as, clutching her sister Patience's hand, she stepped onto the deck of the Anne. Or perhaps you might have heard Mary Read cursing her family as she set out for the Caribbean and an unlooked-for life of criminality and female friendship. Round this corner, from here, you might have been the first person to walk under the river, shoulder to shoulder with Brunel, or here, picked up a diamond ring from among the soil and refuse of a city all but overwhelmed by its own sewage, cholera and typhoid constant companions to the mudlarks in search of treasure along the low tide mud. Along this passageway, this is a place of the unburied, tarred bodies rising in chains out of the receding tide, grinning reminders to passing ships of the fates of pirates. Not all rum, sex and fancy clothes, after all. And the resurrection, then, making midnight contracts with the anatomists of Guy's Hospital. There's quite a few of my ancestors buried in this boneyard. At least I hope they are. A final resting place in the churchyard of St Mary's is not quite final, nor so restful. And the jumpers, of course, dragged out by the watermen when dying seems simpler than living. The dead have a way of rising around here, a bit early for Judgment Day. So here you are, indecisive on the bank of the river. It's quite a drop these days. The water's cleaner than it has ever been, allegedly, depending on how far back you go. It won't be the filth that kills you these days. Are you sure it's as bad as that, lovey? The kind voice of the copper leaning confidentially at your elbow, considering the drop with you. Is it as bad as that? Away you come. That's it. Through this alley. We're not afraid of Captain Kidd, are we? Now, around this corner. That's it, yes. Down these steps. There, nothing to be afraid of. Mary Read, dressed as a man, smoked, swore. She used to call herself by her dead brother's name, used to fight for king and country all round Europe. But peace and boredom intervene, and at last the death of her man nags her into returning to sea. The relief of breeches and a salt wind, she confides to her shipmate as they rest between battles, no longer on the side of the king. And the shipmate plants a kiss on her lips and pulls Mary's hand within his jerkin to feel the soft curve of a womanly breast. Anne Bonny claims that she had no idea Mary was a woman the first time she kissed her. My eye, Mary declares, lighting her long clay pipe. But despite that kiss and fumble, and perhaps more that neither will admit to, Mary escapes the hangman's noose by dying of a childbed fever before they have a chance to string her up.
You like that one, Ed?
Dreamless, blessed in the dark halls of sleep, Basil must sometimes, between deep and shallow, wake to memory. Had he been a gardener, wood might have bent and bloomed for him. A kind of blossom once curled from the plain, a smooth, dense left behind of made by hand. Close as he ever came to leaf or bud. How can you dream of sawdust? But pine, yellow or white, or the rich rose-coloured dust of mahogany. Basil dreams their drift on the floor in the clean smell of resin, and beads thread through his sleep, tiny sores. Irritably, he swats his forehead. Pests, he mumbles. What? Bees. Where? In my workshop. Must have left the window. Bees! He's been dreaming! Such rich symbolism. Stands for immortality. The Great Mother. Messages. She knew, if she waited, as she spoons his soup, those bees you dreamt. Give it a rest, Trace. I told you. Not dreamed. Remembered. Yes, he remembers all right. The buzz of conversation. Blokes with their pecs straining check shirts. Their small moustaches wet with beer. A jukebox. Men dancing. First time ever he's seen all those tight bums waggling, men laughing, as if they felt entitled. Kissing? Basil feels as if his shirt, his tash, his new grown muscles, weeks of preparation, are only borrowed. Headlong he flees, gets tangled in the door. Hey, where's the past? Ah, Terry. Enough years, sweet and sour domestic plod, the rows when Terry strayed, the healing nights, the garden shaved, sink scrubbed, school taught, Terry's haute cuisine when neighbours came, all swept away. His puzzled navy eyes, the drip, the sores, the stink, and at the last, Basil's only act of heroism. He clambers on the hospital bed and holds his lover in his arms. Basil, drifting now to the sound of bees, won't allow his dreams, knows he knows how to die. He only needs a witness. This is mostly from the beginning. I've cut a chunk out to keep it short. Catherine is a lesbian. She's the only person who's ever actually said, yes, I'm a lesbian in her biography when she sent me stuff. A lot of the stuff that I have in the books that is about lesbians and gays, I don't know whether the writer is or not. I know Paula isn't because she's told me so, but apart from that. Anyway, you'll have to imagine the American accent here, because accents is something I don't do much of. Occasionally I can drift into it, but then it tends to go Yorkshire if I try to do that. Something about the long A's, I think. A gorgeous, meaty smell pulsed from the open half that separated the restaurant from the lacquered bar where Penn waited for Amy 233, the first meeting. She was early, straight from yoga, trying to decide what she wanted. She ordered the Think Pink Rosé tasting flight. If one was unpalatable, she could move on to the next. She tasted the first wine set before her. Penn suffered displacement, having lost a day somewhere, or her voice, or an important list, or the spelling of her middle name. Perhaps her chakras were out of whack. They were whacked. Maybe wacky. Penn's first chakra, her base chakra, even her second and possibly third chakras were undercharged. Or was it overcharged? One or the other. Her chakras were whacked and her empty stomach soured at the first rosé. Shouldn't pink wine taste sweet? More like candy? Were her sense receptors whacked too? Maybe she was miswired. Plugged. Unplugged. Tripped at the breaker. The heartbreaker, ha! Thought Penn, with a bit of an ugly twist around her second chakra, getting ripped on blush wine, another symptom of a shocking chakra problem. She balanced her elbows, sipped from the third pink. This one reminded her pleasantly of Andre's pink champagne, prom night, and Henry, devoted in his performance of true love, if not exactly straight. That stood for something. Her consciousness expanded. Cologne. An older guy at the wine bar, all in his dark blue Italian suit and banana-coloured tie. Polish on his nails. Mr. Advertising Man, with his two olive martini. Well, hello, he offered. Hi, yes, she said. It seemed polite to take less space on her stool to make more room for his elbows. Mr. leaned close with questions. He was handsome in a fatherly, aftershave kind of way. He popped an olive, grinning. I like you, he said, for no good reason. My date? Waiting for my date? She was vague, looking pinkly through her fourth taste. Oh, your girlfriend, he said, all sly like a fox, sinful silver fox. Mr. Hipster. You buy? Asked Mr. Hipster with it. Maybe my first wife was bi, or even lesbian. She was so angry. Is it easy to tell? Sure it is, Penn said. Easy. I thought so, Peg, he said. It was easy to mix her up. This did not help her self-esteem, a depletion of the third chakra. She pictured her esteem in a dismal little pile, like underpants kicked under a bed. Her first and second chakras were probably in the toilet. She needed the bathroom. But would she miss Amy 233? It was 233, not 223. What if she'd emailed back and forth with 233 but made a date with 223? There was probably more than one Amy. What if she was mixed up? Pen often got mixed up with other people. The wrong kind of people. She would get herself mixed up with someone else, forgetting her own name or such, thinking she was someone's mirror or their mattress or any number of home furnishings. Then suddenly her chakras were kicked under the bed. Nose powdering, she said, Mr. chuffed, elbows expanding, endangering her flight. But she was brave. She pushed away. Mr. ordered another martini.